linoleum knife.
Getting the new year...
Excuse me, I'll say that again. Linoleum knife.
Getting that new year started with a bang.
And that's the theme song to Linoleum Knife that our latest iTunes reviewer doesn't like.
Oh, well. But he was very nice about everything else.
So. He likes everything else. He just doesn't like that new... Well, it's not even new anymore. No. He doesn't like the theme music.
Well, too bad. I think it's great.
I like it. And but, you know, when I hear someone say, oh, I don't like this thing that you like, mm-hmm. which is sort of the nature of
being a critic
podcast, yeah. I think, wait, do I?
Am I wrong?
Do I? No, am I wrong? But how is what I brought to the listening different than what that person brought to the listening? Like, to the listening, I bring... The fact that I like Blue as a dude.
Yes.
Like, I know him, and I like him, and he's a good guy. He brought a sous vide to our house and cooked an egg in it once.
That's right.
And it was great.
He's also...
I'd never had a sous vide before. I'd never had any food sous vide-ed
right.
ever before that egg. And then I now always, I can say, guess what I've eaten? Guess what I ate? An egg from a sous vide. And... And so
I've been
all of that informs my listening
right.
while I hear the song.
And I've been a fan of his music for ages. So.
Yes, you have. And I, you know, so, and I appreciate his music as well.
Yes.
So
I'm just thrilled that we have a
furthermore, theme song correct, Blue, and I'm happy that we have a theme song.
And I love that one, you know. I think
one that we can call our own.
I think it's also the kind of thing...
we won't get sued for playing.
Exactly. Always a plus. I think, you know, maybe it requires, maybe it's an age thing that if you weren't around for, you know, the 60s and 70s, you might miss the...
the musical influences
yes.
of the Bugaloos, for example.
Sure, or yes. like, you know, music for 1001 Strings.
Also that.
You know, so whatever. We're sticking with it, and that's our story.
That's, yeah.
This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema.
Yeah.
Happy 2015, everybody.
Happy 11th day of Christmas
yes.
to you, Alonzo Duralde.
And to you, Dave White, film critic of movies.com.
I should have said what you are.
That would have helped.
You're the film critic
I'm
of that truck.
Of the garbage truck, yes. Two thumbs down.
You're the film critic for The Rap.
Yes.
And also for What the Flick, which is not an internet... It's all, both of them are from the internet. One is a writing scenario. The other is a you on the camera situation.
I was waiting for you to pull yourself out of that syntactical hole.
In one of the critical ways that you criticize, it's with writing. And the other one is with...
talky words.
Talking in the camera with your face.
Yes, well-described English major.
All I do is make... words with the typing.
And with on this show, with,
yeah.
with your mouth.
Yeah, I forgot. Also here with my mouth.
Yes.
On the show.
So, sorry we're late this week. I was feeling bad this weekend. I got the post-Christmas...
feeling bad for yourself.
...crud that was floating around, but thank you all for your...
I don't think it was floating. I think you just had a sinusy day.
Well, I don't know what
and
it
was. That was your... And that with combined with a mild fever of some sort. That made you sweat
mm-hmm.
into the bathrobe that I had just brought back from the laundromat.
Yes. I think...
Now it's got to go back to the laundromat.
I think my body just had a post-holiday shutdown for a day. But anyway, I'm feeling much better now. Thank you.
It had to get all the ham out of your system.
That's right. I was sweating a lot of ham. But yeah, after much soup and tea and neti potting and Vicks inhalers...
Remember the great ham sweats of 2015?
That's my band name, Ham Sweats.
I am...
We still have so much crap food in this house, by the way.
I wouldn't call it crap.
No, you know what I mean, though. Unhealthy treats.
Chocolates and cookies. We have a lot of chocolates left, and we have a lot of cookies left.
Yes.
That's
not good for us.
We don't have anything... That's all we have, though, that's bad.
Yeah.
Everything else is real food.
true.
That's, well, it's all left, it's in the freezer.
Right.
You know, for some future, also, non-Christmas day.
Also, tons of booze, but since neither of us are going to attack
it, that's just going to sit in the closet.
And it's not going to go bad, heaven knows.
Yeah, that'll just sit in the closet until the next boozy person comes over and says, what kind of boozes do you have?
We'll say all the boozes.
We got all the boozes. You're welcome to have.
Well, you enjoy booze.
It's like when people bring you a bottle of cream sherry, and you look at it and you go, "You just wanted to clean out your own house."
No, I
that's
grew
what
up,
we have, you know.
I know. I grew up drinking dry sherry. That's what my parents always liked. It's a very Spanish thing, the dry sherry.
Right.
Cream sherry, not so much. Of course, and I always think of those tacky Harvey's Bristol Cream ads in the '70s, because that's what that was sherry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know. I'm looking at half of the bottles right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like three times that many bottles in the back room.
Yeah.
In the office.
Yeah.
And
we're not drinkers. We're just not drinkers.
No, we're not. Like, a glass of wine with dinner.
Yeah.
A bottle of beer for breakfast and...
and a healthy shake.
And, yeah. But that's it. And so we have three huge bottles of vodka in the freezer.
I went a little nuts at Costco this year.
And
I overestimated
this gigantic vat of Johnny Walker something or other. It's like a tiny children's swimming pool sized bottle of cheap Costco whiskey.
Well, it's not cheap whiskey.
Is it not cheap? I don't know what is Johnny Walker cheapo or is it good?
It's considered okay. I mean, this was the red. The Johnny Walker blue apparently is the super schmance.
Is it the color blue?
No, it's the but the scotch itself is still brown.
What do we have?
We have the red, which is nice and fine. It's just not the blue.
Nice and fine.
It is nice and fine.
Well, isn't there a black?
I think there's a black in there too. I guess I don't know. I don't drink scotch.
How?
I always think of that line in Mrs. Parker in The Vicious Circle when they're at a speakeasy and she orders one brown and one clear.
Well, yeah.
That's about as much as I know about booze most of the time. Is it brown or is it clear?
I don't like the clears.
I'm more clear than brown.
I like the brown.
I'll have the occasional brown.
I'm going to move the mic.
Okay.
It's going to make a noise. I just need it closer to me.
Okay.
All right. I don't want to be accused of... Smacking it.
No one is begrudging you, Mike.
So anyway, if you are an alcoholic and you want to come over, you come on over and get a giant bottle of booze.
Just promise to barf elsewhere.
All you have to do when you get it is take it to your house and drink yourself stupid there. Don't bring it around me.
No,
we're just going to save this till Christmas of next year.
Yeah, well, this is not really an invitation.
It doesn't go bad.
You're not getting our booze.
I mean, if you want to come over, you can still come over. I'll just make you, like, some waffles or whatever. Stuff. That booze was expensive. We're saving it for the next Christmas party. Just dust off those bottles next December.
Exactly. It's not like they're...
Welcome, special friends.
They're not going to have turned over time.
Some of them didn't even get opened.
No. Again, our friends, I think, are not big drinkers either, obviously, or they would have made more of a dent in that stuff.
Why don't we know more exciting people?
Or maybe the ones who are just didn't come to the party, right?
They were home drinking.
I guess so. Why leave the house?
So we have, well, what do we want to do? Like, okay, next week.
Yes.
We have guests.
And what we
hope they're going to come over, and we're going to all talk about our favorites.
Right. In what we hope will become an annual tradition
of 2014. Are you sure? Is this a definite?
No, they both say yes. So joining us next week will be Manola Dargis of the New York Times and Robert Abley of the Los Angeles Times.
Yes,
who were on the show last January to talk about the best films.
And then Robert was on when Rachel True was on too.
True, he was. They were on to talk about the best films of the previous year, and now they'll be on next week to talk about the best of 2014.
Yeah.
So, before we get to all that positivity, this week we're going to talk about the worst films of 2014.
Yes. Do we do that now, or do we talk about what's new this week?
We can do it whenever we want.
Let's do it after we talk about what's new this week.
Okay. Well, the only thing that's new this week is Woman in Black 2, colon, what, Book of Shadows? What's the Legend of Curly's Gold? What is it?
Angel of Death.
Angel of Death, thank you.
I am going to go first, though.
Okay.
With our commercial.
Oh, this is up front.
Do it. No, let's just do it right away.
Okay. Linoleum Knife is brought to you by...
The Real Truth. Everything you didn't know that you needed to know about making an independent film by Reed Martin. This weekend, a few listeners out there may be kicking off 2015 with a resolution to finish that screenplay they have kicking around, or to start that movie script that they've always wanted to write. But did you know that in this age of small... I'm sorry. That in this age of email... that he looked like an S. Protecting your screenplay and all the brilliant dialogue you've written to make it clever and unique is a lot tougher than it used to be. Writers are so eager to get the material read by anyone that they gladly send their scripts over the internet to anyone who asks, as an unprotected PDF file, or even as an unlocked Microsoft Word file, something you should never really do. 3-day FedEx for $8 or priority mail with tracking, still the way to go. The Real Truth explains all these things to you, also covers the intricacies of copyright registration, and explains how it is not the same as a registration with the Writers Guild, which in itself does not bestow official copyright protection that can be defended in court. You will read about this and 540 pages of other advice on how to avoid derailing your first or second film in The Real Truth. That's R-E-E-L. Available on Amazon, on iTunes for tablets and e-readers, or in bookstores near you. The end.
Thank you, Reed Martin, for your support of Linoleum Knife. And yeah, if you are itching to make that movie that's in your head become a movie...
Even if you're just belly itching.
...that is on the screen, or even if you're just belly itching, read the book.
That's kind of what I am always doing.
Give us a picture.
Belly itching.
Belly itcher.
I'm just a belly itcher most of the time.
Well.
But I'm pretty accomplished.
At belly itching?
I have some ribbons.
But you're not yet on a bubble.
State Fair of Texas. It was either that or enter the butter sculpture contest. And I could never get a sculpture made out of the butter because I kept licking it.
So delicious.
All right, Woman in Black 2.
Yeah.
The Angel of Death.
Yes.
So the Woman in Black has not changed her outfit.
No.
She's still in the house.
No one's cleaned up that nursery.
The house has been... Now the house has become, like, super abandoned. It's a squat, essentially.
Yeah, I had to look
up... For some World War II orphans.
I had to look up my old review to even remember what happens in one. Because I remember vaguely thinking it was okay.
Harry Potter does some stuff.
Yes.
Loses his mind.
He's like a haunted widower with a child. But, yeah, but that one was set immediately after World War I.
Correct.
So we're now several decades later, the house has been abandoned, and it's now being used to house London orphans fleeing the Blitz in 1941.
Here's the funny part about this. One of many funny parts.
Hilarious. What?
They get to the house, and, like, windows are broken out, you know, like, there's no... It's barely a shelter.
Yeah.
Okay. And they make up all these makeshift beds, you know, they've got... They're woolens and things. Yeah, yeah. And they're all as cozy as they can be in this one sort of space. There's still no heat in this
No, house. All I could think of was that the damp of it all.
There's still no heat in this house. And...
They're on the moors somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's England. It's not nice outside.
They are...
They're brutally cold.
They're somewhere so marshy that the road disappears when the tide comes in.
And the main female character in the movie sleeps in this...
Like a peignoir.
Bare shoulder nightie. With her arms... With her shoulders and arms and torso, upper torso above her breasts. Thoroughly exposed to this freezing air. Not even burrowed under the blanket. Like, and this is a thing that happens in the film.
Yeah.
You see her in the flimsiest clothing.
She should be wearing
even when she's outside. She's got on this cotton dress and this little twin set kind of sweater, and her arms sort of crossed in front of her, like, I have a chill.
She should have 8 bathrobes with a zipping floor on.
There should be a gigantically heavy woolen coat on every single square inch of every person's body in this movie. I know that was a digression about something that was sort of incidental and doesn't really have anything to do with the story or the plot. But it's to me, it's little tiny details like that that let me know that someone's not fully
paying attention.
Someone's not fully caring about the quality of this movie,
right?
And I expect more from Hammer. I have always expected more from Hammer. I expect a good, solid, atmospheric, boring horror movie.
That is kind of their specialty.
And I am not happy until I get that.
What's so annoying about this movie is that you can sort of...
Oh, keep going, because you're going to say what I was going to say.
You were giving me hands.
I'm telling
you. Is that you can see the note cards where this was, at some point, kind of a cool idea in terms of... You have these people who are traumatized. You know, they've already been dealing with the shelling of London, the Blitz, you know.
They are children, for the most part.
Yeah, mostly children, but the adults, too, are also traumatized.
So are the adults.
You know, the head...
The kids are the ones who start dying.
like in the first movie, it's the kids who get killed in these movies.
That's good.
The headmistress, though, you know, like her husband is in the military. She has two grown-up sons that are serving. You have one kid who literally has become an orphan the night before. Yeah, that's hilarious, too. You're the worst. You have this army guy who's sort of making eyes at the young professor or the young school mistress, and you find out he's got this sort of tortured past.
He's the warhorse boy.
The warhorse guy, right? Yeah. And so it's kind of like, all right, so the idea of a haunted house movie where the characters are all already haunted themselves
I like that idea.
A cool idea. Great idea. Yep. Let's do nothing with that.
Yeah, let's just throw things at them out of the dark and make everyone go boo and
jump. Let's just do PG-13 jump scares.
Yeah. Ugh. What you need is someone to crack the whip, that hammer, and say no to the jump scares.
No.
To say yes to solidly dreadful, creepy, atmospheric, and boring horror movies. And I'm not using this word boring as
a pejorative.
Hammer does a very specific thing, and they always have. and it should be kind of stodgy and stately. And that's what I want. Don't go updating this
formula.
This formula to try to please I don't even know who, because when I was a child I liked the Hammer movies on TV.
And you knew there was going to be some foot dragging.
And I knew they were going to be boring. And I was like, I'm so excited to watch this anyway.
I'm waiting for Christopher Lee to come back as Dracula.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so... Or the Gorgon.
Yes.
Which is the greatest film of all time. The Gorgon. Oh, but it is. The Gorgon is the greatest film of all time. I know I've paid a lot of lip service to Bresson.
And Destroy All Monsters.
And... Destroy All Monsters.
Those two always get
always
mentioned
chanting
the same
Godard breath. Forever. But in reality, it is the Gorgon that is the greatest film of all time, and it is from Hammer. And so, I just want the Gorgon to come back. I wish there had been the Gorgon in this movie. She could have very easily.
The woman, that's the other thing.
Showed up.
The woman in black.
She's the Gorgon, after all.
It's such an afterthought in this movie.
Yeah.
It could be.
You're barely afraid of her.
You could make this the sequel to just about anything. I mean, really, all the main thing I remember from that first movie is the road that disappears when the tide comes in. And that does play into this one as well.
Yeah.
It is such a first week of January kind of release.
I am more afraid of the Nazis dropping bombs on these children.
Yeah.
Than I am of the woman in black, to Angel of Death.
And in fact, I was trying to think afterwards.
Ripping out their hearts or whatever.
And I know our Brits who listen, James, Anthony, the rest of you out there, are there movies about the young children who survived the Blitz, who were then traumatized by that as adults, that came out in the late 50s, early 60s, or even later, Because I've seen a bunch of movies about the Blitz now. You know, I mean, Hope and Glory is probably still my favorite.
I've seen more movies about children who thought World War II was a wonderful party than exactly. I have. Yeah. About now that was me just hitting my microphone.
You know,
I've seen more movies about that than I've seen movies about adults who are actually traumatized by the war.
What are the kids who didn't go to Narnia? What happened to them?
Yeah.
Are there movies about this? I've never seen one and would be kind of curious to see a movie about somebody like in their 20s in, you know, what, was London swinging
you
by
could,
then?
You could say that most early Roman Polanski films were about this subject, but...
that's different.
Yeah.
So, just a thought. And again, the reason I'm having these kind of thoughts is because Woman of Black 2 was a big snooze, and so my mind wandered to other topics. So yes, that's the only new movie this week. We do need to play a little catch-up on some of the year-end releases, which, if you aren't living in L.A. or New York, are quite likely not in your area yet anyway, but, you know, what the heck. First and foremost, being one of my favorite films this year, and Dave and I have not talked about this yet, so I will be finding out, alongside our listeners, what you thought of it. J.C. Shandor's A Most Violent Year.
Why don't you tell people what happens in it?
Okay.
Did it get a wide release? Or is it
no,
only...
I think it just got L.A. New York so far.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Okay. So it stars Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain, and he runs a fleet of trucks that deliver heating oil in the New York area.
Yeah.
And it is, of course, a very sort of mobbed up, dangerous business, and there's truck jacking going on. He has just put down a rather sizable deposit on this tank facility, I guess, where he'll be able to store, and it's going to move him up in the business and make things better. Right. But he's got to then pay this balance after 30 days, and making that happen is going to be a challenge because people keep kidnapping his trucks, and there's all this other stuff going on. His wife, meanwhile, is the daughter and sister of mobsters, and so she's always ready to, like, crack her knuckles and get, you know, nasty. And while the husband is not above that kind of thing, he's at some level trying to stay legit in a business that is thoroughly not legit. I found this movie really engrossing, and one of the things that's so cool about it, it's set in, like, 1981.
Yes.
Nobody ever makes movies set in that 80s. Like, you get movies that are set in the 70s, and then
about American Hustle? When did that? When was that?
That was 70s.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, you get, like, big, flashy, disco dress, leisure suit 70s. Or when you get 80s, suddenly it's, you know, either big dynasty hairdos or, like, new wave, whatever.
Yep.
This is that 1981, very early in the Reagan years.
It's still the 70s.
It's still the 70s, yep. But it's kind of the grimmest, like, least attractive version. All the women are wearing those silky blouses that have those limp little kind of ties at the neck.
They are, and yet that's not... actually true. There's a woman in the movie that wears that kind of blouse.
I thought there were a couple.
I'll get to this period details in a minute, because I had a bit of an issue with that.
Oscar Isaac wears a camel hair coat that is a few shades of yellow shy of Dick Tracy territory. Mm-hmm. There's a particularly kind of depressing look of that period that I thought the movie nailed pretty well. They move into their dream house, which is this box. It's one of those
modern
boxes. Houses.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of this writer-director.
Me too.
This is his third film, and I think they have a certain thematic, you know, through line, but they're all told so very differently. His first one was Margin Call, which was set kind of on the night before the market died in the early 2000s. And then there was All Is Lost, which I thought was just so great, with Robert Redford, you know, kind of doing a one-man show as a guy lost at sea. I think, you know, you make one movie, great, but, you know, that could be a fluke. You make two, okay, well, that's, you're getting somewhere. I think with three, we can safely say that this guy is really somebody to be to watch and who is, I think, really matters. I found this movie just fascinating. I didn't know anything about it going in. I was completely drawn into the story and these characters. I liked how he, you know, this gets thrown around a lot, but I think this was a genuinely Lumetian movie. You know, it's very much
absolutely.
It's very much that kind of working class or, you know, slash, you know, criminal class, you know, New York movie of what's going on behind the scenes and who greases the wheels. And while on the one hand it's a very powerful drama, it will suddenly segue into a really exciting action sequence where there's a truck chase, you know.
Right.
And he handles that turn really, really skillfully. So I love this movie.
I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree so much with you on the period detail. I think that for the sake of not turning those details into a joke, they dialed it back very, very, very heavily.
Hmm.
They muted everything down. They made, you know, particularly the clothing choices on everyone, the most tasteful that they could.
I guess that's true. I was so just thinking, 1982, a movie you recommended a few weeks ago as your DVD pick was Frederick Wiseman's The Store.
Yes.
And that's, you know, if you want to see what people were wearing at Neiman Marcus in 1982, that's the movie.
It's kind of like when I look back on a film like Ordinary People that was actually made in 1980.
Sure.
And how anything that anyone is wearing in that film could be worn today with very little adjustment.
Sure.
And it would look fine. And so this film is not like that necessarily, but it's not like that either.
Right.
It's,
well, in the case of Ordinary People,
it's clothing that when you go back and you say, oh, this is what I want to do in my line of fashion for the spring that's going to be influenced by 1981, these are the details you pick. They aren't the outlandish, like, went away quickly sort of ugly stuff that you see in every year.
Sure.
That's something ugly that's popular.
But don't you think these characters, because of their ambitions and because of their desire to...
They're dressing rich.
Exactly. Yeah. They're dressing for the socioeconomic level that they want rather than they have. So I think they would pick that stuff.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, what I'm saying is that the period detail is good. It's just
muted.
It's as though no one in the movie has bad taste. And I find that a little hard to believe, you know.
Well, I think the characters, I think they're either aggressively striving or they are so working class that they aren't going to be wearing trendy stuff anyway.
Yeah, but the trendy stuff was cheap by then. And so
I guess okay, it's a fair point.
It's,
it didn't take me out of the movie.
It didn't take me out of the movie, but it's always a thing I notice. I always notice production design. Mm-hmm. I always notice set decoration. I always notice clothing, hairstyles. If you've got the wrong stuff in a period film, I'm annoyed. If you're playing it safe in a period film, I'm a tiny bit annoyed. not. To the point where I'll tell you made a bad movie.
Sure. Well, I mean, in the case of Ordinary People, obviously...
This only annoys me a tiny bit.
These are Chicago people who live on the lake, so obviously they're going to be like, you know... Preppy doesn't change that much from year to year.
No, it does not.
You know, and that whole... And obviously part of the point of Ordinary People is this woman has made her life look like a lifestyle catalog.
Yes.
But no, I see what you're saying.
What I like about this movie... are how the characters really are what drives the story. The plot is not especially driving. It's a guy who's got a couple days to get things together for a bad situation that he's about to fall into.
Right.
And
meanwhile, sorry, I should have mentioned, while all this is happening, they're being aggressively pursued by an eager assistant DA played by David Oyelowo, who's also in Selma right now.
Yeah.
There's a great scene where they show up with a warrant during their kid's birthday party, and while his men are searching the house, Jessica Chastain delivers him a slice of birthday cake and an F-U look to sear the screen.
It's more than a look. You scratch this character the tiniest bit, and she turns into Carmela Soprano.
My steakhouse!
She's gracious and, oh, mean, no, never, blah, blah. And then on a dime, she's like, you got nothing! and that's really, Jessica Chastain is really
really wonderful. I love her in this. Like, she kind of annoyed me in Interstellar. I didn't see the new Miss Julie she was in, but I heard it was terrible.
I didn't see
it. But boy, is she fun in this.
And I think it so I like how character driven it is. I like that the film prioritizes people over incident. And even though there are plenty of incidents, it doesn't feel like that's what's the most important thing. And Oscar Isaac is this man who, he understands the world he lives in, but he's really trying really, really hard not to be a criminal.
Yes.
And so
he's very Michael Corleone in Godfather 3.
Yeah.
Like he is trying to go legit so desperately, but he can't.
Well, he was never not legit. He was just sort of, you know, but everything around him wants to pull him into being not legit.
But he's trying to climb out of a fairly seamy level without letting it stain him, and there's just no getting up to the next point without getting a little dirty.
Right.
So yeah.
And it looks beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It is shot by Bradford Young, which is a name you might not know, but he shot Selma.
Oh.
And made Selma look so great.
Mm-hmm.
He shot Ava DuVernay's other film,
Middle of Nowhere. Oh, okay.
He's done a whole bunch of stuff, and he is great. I'm looking up his IMDb right now because it's like he came out of nowhere, but he's been working.
Sure, yeah.
And he's been working and making things look really wonderful everywhere he goes. Hang on. Checking this.
Middle of Nowhere, incidentally, is finally coming out on DVD soon. So if you very likely missed it during its fairly limited theatrical run. But if you want to see what the director and star of Selma were up to before Selma, it's a movie definitely worth checking out.
He shot a piece in the Six by Sondheim documentary.
Oh, which one?
Sending the Clowns.
Oh, okay.
He shot Ain't Them Bodies Saints.
Oh, my. Okay, yeah.
Mother of George. Middle of Nowhere.
You're reminding me of
Pariah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah. He's been doing stuff
kind of under the radar, but he's terrific. Yeah. Now that you mention it, Christy brought this up and we were reviewing this on What the Flick. And yeah, I didn't like Ain't Them Body Saints, but boy, was it pretty to look at.
Yeah. He makes everything pretty to look at.
Yeah.
Down for that. All right. What else were you at here? It's a good movie.
Yeah.
I like. It is playing currently on 4 screens nationwide.
Okay. Well, it's coming to you soon.
Maybe it will come to you.
it's released by A24, and, you know, usually, you know, distributors, they have good stuff and they have bad stuff, whatever. But on my top 10 list this year, there were 3 or 4 movies that A24 distributed. 4, actually.
One.
They did Locke. They did Under the Skin.
Oh, they did.
They did Obvious Child and Most Violent Year, so... That's, you know, none of these guys are fail-safe, but, you know, usually if it's from A24, like if it's from Strand, if it's from, Oscilloscope.
Or Annapurna.
Annapurna. Well, they're not a distributor, they're a production company.
Okay.
Or, you know, Cinema Guild. There's like, you know, definitely keep an ear open because they generally got good stuff.
Yeah.
We had the 2 Painter movies.
Big Eyes
and Mr. Turner.
Mr. Turner. I have not yet seen Mr. Turner.
Yes.
But I am going to see Mr. Turner.
Yes. We'll loop back it because
I'm very excited to see Mr. Turner.
I want to hear what you have to say about it.
Just having a time.
As an art bro, I want to hear what your thoughts are on this movie.
I'm a super next level art.
Such a next level art bro.
Real art bro.
Mr. Turner is Mike Leigh's latest movie. Like Topsy Turvy, it is a fact-based biopic, in this case about the legendary British painter J.M.W. Turner, played by Timothy Spall, in the gruntinest performance probably since Peter Boyle in Young Frankenstein.
Yes. He's the man they named the Turner Prize after.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not your traditional sort of life story biopic. It picks up fairly late in his life, but you get an idea of who he was and how he worked and, you know, what a pain he could be in his personal life and his relationship with his father and all that kind of stuff. It's a movie where not a lot happens, but at the end you really feel like you've seen something and you've gotten to know, you know, you've gotten sort of a look at an artist and his process and the context of his times and how he sort of was one of the early people to dabble in Impressionism and people thought he was nuts. And
he helped lay the groundwork for what modern painting would become.
Yeah.
You know, he was one of those, he was one of the people who pushed it forward.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the film yet. I just know things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, paint to him was not necessarily the thing you used to make something else look exactly like everyone thought it should look.
Right.
Paint was a material to express with.
And, exactly.
And that was an idea that you know, he helped to push.
Yeah. So you get an idea of where he sort of stood in among the painters of his day. This is yet another movie that's about how critics are all jerks.
They are.
We've been getting a lot of those lately.
They are.
This and Top 5 and Birdman.
The critics are jerks.
Yeah.
Let's just admit it right now.
Fine.
We're sorry. No, I'm not sorry. We're jerks.
No, again.
The critics.
I'm going to say this. Yeah. I'm going to say this again. If critics are jerks, that means you can't enjoy a good review. If you are an artist and you get a good review, it must be meaningless to you because it came from someone whose disapproval you claim means nothing.
I think that, I've said this so many times, I think that the idea of a critic as a thumb up or a thumb down person,
mm-hmm.
as a consumer guide, as someone who passes judgment rather than creates, is absolutely not the way things should be.
No.
I believe that, you know, writing about culture is a necessary part of culture. People who want to think about culture and talk about culture and talk about it and think about it with other people, they're going to write about it, or they're going to get on a podcast and talk about it, or they're going to get on a, you know, well, there aren't any more TV shows where this sort of thing happens when, unless you're in France. and that's part of the conversation that happens around art. Writers whose subject is the culture, they have to get out there and do that. They have to get out there and do their thing. Now, what has it turned into? It's turned into this gross dissection, you know, this checklist of stuff that you hold a cultural product up next to and say, well, it doesn't meet these criteria, so, you know, bad, out, and... Or, you know, I declare this is excellent and worth your money. And that's right. Really what drives me crazy. Pardon the digression.
And it's a minor thing in this movie. It's not as big a deal as in some of the other films of the moment.
When I see Mr. Turner, I'll have more to say about it. You'll
whine about it, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll talk about it more when you see it. I'm really curious to hear your take on it. But, you know, it's Mike Lee. He's great. And this is a Dynamite movie. And
Dynamite.
It is Dynamite.
Crackerjack. Top notch.
It is a powerful and engrossing film. Timothy Spall gives an engagingly repellent performance.
I like those.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
He's terrific. So, yeah, I very much recommend this movie. People should check it out. And again, you have to kind of follow its pace and let it lead you on a bit of an amble, you know, a bit of a ramble, a bit of a meander, but you'll enjoy where you wind up.
Well, all right.
And then there's Big Eyes.
Big Thighs.
Oh.
It's the biopic about me.
Oh. So it's Tim Burton reuniting with his Ed Wood screenwriters.
Yes.
Scott Alexander and Larry Kazurski.
Mm, yeah.
this time to tell another story about another sort of American outsider artist, Margaret Keane, whose big eye waif paintings were all the rage in the 50s and 60s and are now considered sort of classic kitsch.
Yes.
And it's about her relationship with her husband, who for
was
years
a sociopath.
Took credit for having done all the paintings himself until she finally took him to court and proved in front of a judge that she could paint one right there on the spot and he could not. And
he was a grifter.
What's hilarious is, you know, every year whenever there's a nonfiction films are out during Oscar season, like out come the truth police, you know.
Yes.
They're trying to go after Selma because it, you know, wasn't fair to LBJ. They're trying to go after, you know, the Imitation Game for this and that.
What are they going after this for?
The idea that apparently that it besmirches Walter Keane somehow.
Well, it should.
This is a guy who not only in during the court case could he not do a big eye painting.
Yeah.
He didn't do one for the decades that elapsed between that trial
Correct.
And his death.
Right.
So, yeah, Walter Keane did not do anything.
Who is defending him?
Okay, you looked. Who is defending him?
His family.
Yeah.
His nephew in particular. Mm. Who owns some of the Keane paintings and who claims that his mother saw Walter Keane painting them.
That's it.
There you go. Yeah. Says she saw Walter paint and she was just so hurt when Margaret started saying she painted the pictures in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, Margaret Keane's still alive, so and, she wins.
Yeah. I mean, okay. you know, you can have, you know, anecdotal evidence back and forth all the time, but the man didn't paint anything in court or after.
Yeah.
When it was final, when the jig was up,
mm-hmm.
he stopped.
Yeah.
And she kept doing it.
Mm-hmm.
In the style to which everyone had become accustomed.
Right.
So either she was a great copier of him and his talent.
And somehow challenging him in court stripped him of his ability to ever paint again.
But she somehow, like, succubused all of the big eye out of him and into her own, you know, a body.
Or.
That would be like you. I don't know what. I was gonna make some comedy example of you stealing some ability of mine, but I don't have many abilities.
You have
so there you go.
If I could suddenly make a decent salted sea salt chocolate chip cookie,
well, yeah, I do that pretty well.
Yes,
yeah,
and you are the king of pancakes.
But you could easily have learned how to do that from watching television the way I did.
This is true. Nonetheless, this movie...
This conversation is pointless.
It is pretty pointless. I was not down for this. I was looking forward to this movie because, I, you know, I think Ed Wood is probably Tim Burton's best film or one of them. And, you know, I like these writers. They did the Larry Flint movie. They did the Andy Kaufman movie. And I was trying to figure out why... What does this movie not have that those other movies had?
Courage.
Courage. No, the other movies had a sense of family to them. You know, like Ed Wood had these other people around him who sort of believed in what they were doing, even though what they were doing was ridiculous. You know, and Larry Flint had these people that were close to him, you know, supporting his crazy dream of, you know, like gross pornography. But because this movie is about two people who are keeping a secret.
Yeah.
There's no anybody around them. Like you
Correct.
Get you get Kristen Ritter as sort of like, you know, Margaret's one female friend. But because she's being kept at arm's distance and not being told the truth about things, she doesn't really factor much into it. And so it just really kind of winds up being about these two, this awful, exploitive, abusive marriage.
Yes.
And I didn't find it all that interesting because he's overplaying madly.
He is. Christoph Waltz is really overacting.
And Amy Adams just winds up kind of playing this sort of porcelain saint, you know, slash victim until she finally gets out from under his clutches.
Yes.
And I just, it all felt very kind of simplistic. And if these weren't real people and the art weren't sort of memorably bizarre, it wouldn't be much of a story.
I liked it more than you did, and I think the reason I did is because, in spite of what you think about them, and yes, this is a story of an abusive marriage, and she is shy, and that's hard to convey. And so it was easy for him to dominate her because of her shyness.
Because whatever Patel he lacked as a painter, he had in spades as a huckster.
Yeah. And so, but what I did like about this film is the idea that I said in my review that has not yet posted on movies.com that it's a horror film. That certain scenes are framed as horror.
Sure.
And the rest of the film is about fear. And it's about personal fear on the part of, you know, Margaret Keane. It's about Walter Keane's fear of discovery and of his own emasculation. It's about the art world being afraid of mass taste. And
women.
And women. And it's about the masses being afraid of the art world and rejecting that small community's ideas in favor of something that they can pick up at Woolworth's.
Right.
And so, in that moment, you had someone like Andy Warhol making art about repetition and about pop. But Margaret Keane was repetition and pop. She never did anything different. You go to her website right now.
She's still doing them?
She's still doing Big Eyes. Mm. Now, it's stylistically somewhat changed. She's evolved, you know. But everybody got the Big Eyes. She doesn't. That's what she does. Mm. And you can still buy it, you know, cheaply or expensively, depending on your price point needs. Mm. And so there's a really, really cool moment in the film where she is in the supermarket. And she's buying Campbell's soup. She's picking it up off the shelves, putting it in her cart. And she turns the corner, and there is all of her posters and postcards and stuff on a display. She's an end cap.
Right.
Meanwhile, the supermarket is impeccably designed in this repetitive, brightly colored, you know, pop, the way we think of pop art now.
Sure.
It's designed that way.
Yeah.
And so she is embodying the present tense of art in that moment. And that scene is also sort of predicting the future of art, because if you know things like Damien Hirst's
right, the pharmacy
work, the pharmacy exhibit, which is just this, you know, beautifully weird, unhappy pharmacy display.
Well, it's like when we first
or his grid polka dot paintings, which are everywhere. They're so everywhere that every Gagosian outpost in the past year or two showed Damien Hirst grid polka dot paintings at the same time. And there are like 13 Gagosians all over the world.
Yeah.
They even had like a contest.
If you could go to all
13 galleries.
If you
went to all 13 of them,
You got
one or something. Yeah. And I was like, that's so weird. So she is in her way predicting the future. She's moving toward the future. Mm-hmm. Quality or not quality, the movie doesn't even want to talk about that.
No.
Really, not much, other than through the mouth of a critic.
Played by Terrence Stamp.
Played by Terrence Stamp, who's being snooty and British, portraying a man who was from the Midwest.
Well, Christoph Waltz is playing a guy who's American and he still sounds
German. Well,
German.
Because he can't do an American accent.
Yeah, that's one. I mean, I remember when we first moved here and we started driving by the 99-cent store and, you know, the one on La Brea, and it's a discount store with all these huge display windows. And, you know, each window will have six or seven rows of whatever product it is, of a detergent or a cereal or a foil or whatever, and it's like being in one of those kind of, you know, those kind of installations. Now, I mean, yeah, granted, the these guys are interested in her as a person and her as a sort of a cultural phenomenon, and that aspect of it is fun to watch, and it has some salient points. But ultimately, I felt like I was just sort of seeing another movie about an abusive marriage, and I don't know.
It's not entirely successful. You gleaned those things out of it. Yeah, what it displayed about art and the art world, I was sort of interested in. Yeah,
fair enough.
2 days, one night.
Yes, my first Dardenne Brothers movie.
Baby's first Dardenne Brothers movie. Marion Cotillard plays a woman who has taken time off work thanks to Europe's better laws. Thanks to Europe's better employment labor laws and healthcare. She's taken time off work to deal with her
Depression,
yeah. And when she gets back, she learns that they've crunched the numbers, and they can do without her. Everyone else picked up the slack, and they're going to save some money by making everybody work harder.
Yeah, it's a solar panel factory owned by the Japanese, and they figured out that, or maybe not owned by the Japanese, I don't remember, but anyway, but they figured out that 16 people can be as effective as 17 if they can put in some overtime.
And they're going to put in some overtime, and to reward them all for voting to fire her.
Yeah. Yeah, the voters are given a choice: lay off Marion Cotillard, or you all get €1,000 bonus.
Right.
But because the foreman phrased it as lay off Marion Cotillard, or we're laying off someone else.
Right.
They all voted to lay her off, but one of her friends figures out that that's what happened, and so they convince the boss to let them do a revote the following Monday.
And she spends the entire weekend going from person to person, begging them not to do it.
Yeah.
And, of course, she encounters some people who are sympathetic, some people who are unsympathetic, and some people who have already bought the lie that somehow, by her keeping her job,
they're on the block.
They are being, A, stolen from somehow, or one of them is going to go.
Yeah. Or they just really need that €1,000.
Right.
And it's heart-wrenching because she goes to each...
Like all Dardenne Brothers films,
apparently so.
It's heart-wrenching.
She goes to each person, and she has to kind of repeat the same spiel,
yeah.
And you have to hear her repeat the same spiel over and over again, but it's supposed to be awkward because she has to keep doing it, so of course you have to listen to her do it, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like she's Nora Rae. She is still very fragile. Like
she's full of cries.
Yeah, and very attached to her Xanax. And so it's they need her to work. They have a mortgage. They've got two kids. They need her to have this job. And it's this really, really just devastating and powerful look at, again, the economy today and what it's doing to us and what it's doing to our humanity.
And I would love to spoil the ending because the ending is so...
What I'm going to say about the ending is...
perfectly written.
It should be shown in screenwriting classes forever. Hmm.
Whose class should it be shown in?
I don't teach screenwriting.
I know, but...
But, because it's... It doesn't put a big Hollywood bow on things.
No.
Nor does it leave...
Don't say anything more.
All right.
Don't say anything more. When it comes out on DVD, we can maybe revisit this. I know we say that a lot, and then we never do. But maybe we can remember to do that this time.
Yeah, the ending is perfect.
Yeah.
We'll leave it at that.
So,
I have to say, I have never been a big fan of Marion Cotillard.
Really? I think she's great.
I don't dislike her, but I've never gotten the big deal about her. I didn't think La Vie en Rose was all that good. I thought it was just Valley of the Dolls with subtitles, and not in a good way. I didn't care for her all that much in either of the Nolan movies that she's in. I did love Forehead Tites for funnyordie.com, which if you've never seen, Google Marion Cotillard forehead and it will come up. But yeah, she's great in this. And of course, you know, because she's not wearing makeup, there's all these critics like, oh, how brave, you know.
She's like, do you know what Marion Cotillard looks like without makeup?
Yeah, Marion Cotillard
she
without
makeup.
She still
looks like Marion Cotillard. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's not...
This isn't, you know, Charlize Theron in Monster.
Right.
Trust me. But she's great and super, like, she's a walking exposed nerve and having to kind of, like, go hat in hand over and over and over again to, like, what, 15 or something coworkers over the course of a weekend. It's just,
Here's what I love about the Dardennes. Everything.
Well, somebody brought them up in a conversation about faith-based movies.
Yes.
That they have a real sort of Christian mentality, but they don't clobber you with it.
No, they do not.
There's, oh God, the scene where she goes to the guy in the laundromat. And he like shows compassion to her. That's like, why can't Kirk Cameron make this scene?
Because Kirk Cameron is not capable, talent-wise, of this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Nor does he believe in the things that his religion actually teaches. And so the task of presenting a moral worldview falls to people like the Dardennes, who, you know, I don't know what their religious beliefs are, honestly. But I know what their films are like. And they are absolutely humane. And their films often position people in situations that are impossible or cruel. And they have to fight their way out somehow. And you have seen, because you saw it with me, you saw Maurice Pilat's L'Enfance Nue, or Noy, or however you say that word. Isn't it new?
L'Enfance it might be new.
L'Enfance Nue.
Which is on Hulu Plus, by the way.
Yeah. And that's where these guys come from. I mean, there's a direct line connecting films like that to these guys. And it's very sort of, you know, immediate kind of, this is a very, you know, overused word, but sort of, you know, documentary-like, naturalistic sort of approach that they employ. And I think they're wonderful. They've won the Palme d'Or like 2 times. They almost won it a third. And they should, because I think they're great.
Having seen the other films, I can't say this for certainty, but I will say if you've never seen a Dardenne movie before,
start with this one.
This is a good place to start.
This is a good place to start, yeah.
It has a movie star in it that you will recognize.
Yeah.
But not being handled in a movie star kind of way. I really was impressed by that film. I will now make it a point to seek out their other stuff. I am remiss in not having done so until now, but I will.
All right, I'm going to read this letter, and then we're going to talk about our worst.
Okay.
Hello, fellas. This is from Jesse in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to put a button on your recent reflections about the state of the critic and some of the 2014 headline releases.
Which we were just talking
about. Wait, didn't we already read this?
No, we didn't.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
All right. I was listening to the two of you disagree about the merits of Inherent Vice, which I've been doing on the internet with Facebook friends who all go see Inherent Vice, and they're like, I walked out, what a garbage movie. And I'm like, I love that movie so much, I'm gonna go see it again.
Not with me.
The recurring themes and motifs in Paul Thomas Anderson's work, and found myself thinking, guess I'm gonna have to go and see Inherent Vice in the theater after all to see what I think. That's what criticism is all about. Merry Christmas, you wonderful old building and loom.
Light sleeve.
I know Magnolia is sloppy and kind of nuts, but I was 22 years old when I saw it, and I have fond memories of being super obsessed with it, particularly with the Phil Parma and Linda Partridge thread. So that may always be my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson film. I know it won't be The Master, because that redacted for clean podcast was creepy. To close out the year, while also failing to make a top 10 list, I can tell you that I'm pretty sure my favorite slash best movie of the year was Foxcatcher, or maybe The One I Love. Another example of a movie I saw in the theater because of your enthusiastic discussion about it. I also want to mention how much I love the thriller dance sequence in 13 Going on 30. Happy holidays!
Thank you, Jesse.
All right. Let's do the worst ups quickly, because we've already been doing this for over an hour.
Sure.
Go down your list.
Okay, well, I had some runners-up that I didn't mention, but I mean, you know, certainly St. Vincent, I really wanted to just be dead before that thing was over. And, of course, Transformers was rotten, but it's funny, Bibbs was talking about how as he was saying it, I was thinking it, or right before he said it, I thought the same thing, that he now puts the Michael Bay Transformers movies in the category of, like, unwanted family get-togethers. My metaphor was, it's like going to the DMV. Like, you know, right. It's this thing you're going to have to do every couple of years, and right. You just grit your teeth and you get it over with and it's done. So I didn't even bother to put it on my worst 10 list, but ugh. So going from 10 to 1, my number 10 was Blended. With Adam Sandler, because I mean, really,
how long is Ladysmith Black Mambazo Lifesavers commercial? How many seconds is that? 30 seconds,
probably.
You could watch it two times in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that would mean if I watched it 200 times in a row, that would be the same length as Blended.
Blended might even be longer than that. I don't know.
Let's just say that it's...
Sure.
Yeah. I would rather do that.
The 200...
I would rather watch that 200 times in a row.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Because you know what I like? I like Ladysmith Black Mambazo. You know what else I like?
Lifesavers.
Especially butter rum, which you can't find. Very hard to find the butter rum flavor.
Really? Even at, like, Dylan's Candy Bar?
I've never been inside a Dylan's Candy Bar.
You're not missing much.
It seems unpleasant.
It's a little de trop, but they do have a lot of
We have real candy stores in Los Angeles that we don't need to go into Dylan's.
They have the old timey candies.
We don't need a chain. It's like the Walmart of candy. We don't.
You're
need
right.
To be
you're in right. Fair enough. Okay, number 9. I Frankenstein.
Yo, Frankenstein.
because of Empty City and giant red. Percentage readout.
You sure are taking your time.
Okay, sorry. I'm just going to whip through this. Fine. Number 8 was Pompeii.
Yeah. But for a different reason. Excuse me.
What? Your reason was different than mine? Or?
Well, I've got two lists. You keep going. Though.
Okay. Yeah. Number 7, Tyler Perry's Single Moms Club. number 6, A Haunted House 2.
Yeah.
Number 5, Transcendence.
Yeah.
Number 4, Gambit, which no one saw, and consider yourself lucky.
Yeah.
But it's going to fool people in video stores for years. But, Cameron Diaz and Colin Firth, and written by the Coen brothers? I got to check this out.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Number 3, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. Number 2, Atlas Shrugged 3, Who is John Galt?
Which I still haven't watched.
Oh my gosh, this whole...
Did it ever come out on DVD?
I have no idea.
I don't...
It seemed to have been shot on DVD. And 2 actually got a teeny bit better than 1, so you thought maybe...
Yeah,
like 3,
you thought maybe 3 then.
Yeah, no, 3 is the most bargain basement sort of snuff movie of them all. And I still think that you could
philosophically
make...
Philosophically opposed to... The very philosophy they espouse.
Yeah, they should spend more money on these things. Yeah. and as much as
to
I...
make the very best you can make.
Exactly. As much as I disagree with everything that Ayn Rand has to say, I think you could still make an entertaining Atlas Shrugged movie. These guys didn't do it.
Yeah.
And at number 1 is... I mean, it's my worst movie of the year, but it's also the best bad movie of the year. And that's The Identical.
Oh, God, it's so good.
A movie that I insisted that everyone I know go see, and a lot of them took me up on it, and they agreed that I was right.
It's a delight. A garbage delight.
It is. And it's out on Blu-ray next week, folks, so do pick up a
copy. It's utterly insane. All right, I got two lists.
Mm-hmm.
Worst list number 1
mm-hmm.
is stuff like The Identical. That are...
So you're 0 stars.
The 0 star reviews that Or should have been zeros if they didn't make a zero, whatever. You know, I'm not talking about stars, but
no, but you have a thing. Your zero stars is terrible, and you should see it. A 0.5 stars is terrible, and don't see it.
And there are some films that I will give the points to 0.5 star to that mm-hmm. later I think, no, actually that is such a
that was a full on zero.
It's a full on zero. Like that needs to be seen for its terribleness.
Right.
Yeah. So here are those. I used to write a column for MSNBC every year at the end of the year called Awful is the New Awesome.
Right.
And it was about these kinds of films.
Mm-hmm. One year you included Crash, and Roger Ebert got mad at you.
And Roger Ebert got mad at me. It was my one claim to fame with Roger Ebert. Got mad at me. Called me out in print.
That's right.
Publicly.
Take it to the bank.
Called me smug, and I was so happy.
He noticed.
I felt so noticed.
Dear
by Roger
Diary.
Ebert. Yeah, it was like he talked to me. All right, Endless Love,
blah.
God's Not Dead,
which I need to see.
The Giver, blah. Precision of Language.
Thank You for Your Childhood.
A Haunted House 2,
blah.
Which I laughed all the way through.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my! I just cringe.
The worst. It's just the worst. It's so bad. And as I was laughing, I thought, oh no, I'm laughing. Why am I laughing?
Why
I
are
shouldn't
you laughing?
Be laughing. This is so rotten. Why am I laughing? I don't know why I was laughing.
Oh man. Oof.
I just was.
We'll talk about this later. Go on.
The Identical.
Sure.
This is alphabetical order, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Left Behind. Pompeii.
Mm.
And Saving Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah. Saving Christmas generated a lot of conversation.
Here's list number two. It's a long one. Here goes.
These are the 0.5s. These are the terrible and don't bother.
And So It Goes, Annie, As Above, So Below, Bad Words, Before I Go to Sleep, Blended, Deliver Us from Evil, Devil's Due, Dracula Untold, Horrible Bosses 2, I, Frankenstein, Labor Day, Let's Be Cops, Men, Women, and Children, Need for Speed, No Good Deed, The Nut Job, The Legend of Hercules, Legends of Oz, : Dorothy's Return, Million Dollar Arm, The November Man, Persecuted, The Pyramid, Sex Tape, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, Ride Along, Sabotage, Son of God, Tyler Perry's The Single Moms Club, That Awkward Moment, Vampire Academy, Walk of Shame, Winter's Tale.
Whew. That's quite a list. Thankfully, I didn't see all of them.
Who envies my job? Who among you envies my job?
I think at some point you could probably, if you asked me if a certain thing occurred in Ride Along or Let's Be Cops, I would not be able to tell you which was which.
Right.
The Nut Job.
Yep.
Ugh. The Nut Job made Rio 2 look like Toy Story 3.
Uh-huh.
So that's our worst of the year, and you can, if you Google us, you can find our original reviews of most of these movies, and get the full details of our hate. But yeah, next week, tune in. It's going to be great. Manolo Dargis and Robert Abele to talk about the best of 2014. We'll also be talking about Taken 3 and whatever else happens to cross our path this week.
Tookened.
That's right.
Tooken the third.
Tack 3N. I don't know if they've been billing it that way, but they should, frankly.
Tooken Howell the third.
There you go. As always, we thank you for listening. Oh, do you have a DVD pick this week?
No.
Me neither. We'll do
too
it next
bad.
We'll have one next time, I promise. As always, we thank you for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Check out Rotten Tomatoes Radio and Malton on Movies over at Wolf Pop. Check out Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the B Movies Podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, the Schmoes Know, the Brett Easton Ellis Podcast, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, the Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. Once again, thanking Blue for our wonderful theme music. You can find him online at Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes and leave us a good review. It does help people find the show. We want to thank GQ, Rhino 1975, Big Southern Boy 67, Justifiably Brilliant, Caleb Film Fan, and Monty Erickson for leaving us positive reviews. It does help our placement on the algorithm or whatever, how they decide people get, you know, put on the front page or the whatever the podcast page is at iTunes. So more positive reviews, please. please, if you haven't left one yet, kindly do. You can also stream the show at StitcherRadio.com or TheLounge.com, and you can leave us a little thumbs up there. You can also stream the show with a handy little app on our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. And if you haven't already liked it, please do. You can also check out the Linoleum Knife group page, where our listeners talk to each other about movies. And subscribe to our YouTube channel, which I promise I will be adding more episodes to as soon as we find my tiny external hard drive, which is hiding under a piece of furniture somewhere.
It's Christmas decoration somewhere. It's in this office.
We're going to find it.
I don't know.
Follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. It's also where you can PayPal us for merch. Where are we on t-shirts?
Well, we don't have any left.
No, they're all gone.
They're gone.
Okay.
They're gone.
So
yeah.
The current batch of t-shirts are gone, but we'll be getting more soon. You can buy our extra episodes, Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, for $1.99
yes.
each. We're just past Christmas, so if you don't want to get White Christmas or Santa Claus, there is still The Apple, Clue, Two for the Road, Josie and the Pussycats, and coming very soon...
Next week, in fact.
Yes, is our Poseidon Adventure commentary for the new year, so we'll be putting that together very quickly, and we'll let you know, via Facebook and Twitter and all the other places, when that has gone live. So until then, and until next week, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.